And hello, everyone, and welcome to the Endocrinology of Sleep presentation. This is part of our sleep core module, and we are going to talk today about all the different hormones and how they interact during sleep. And a lot of people think of sleep as just, well, you sleep, it's nothing happening, right? Nothing's happening in your brain, nothing's happening in your body. And actually, the activity of the brain is actually not much less during sleep than it is during the day because there's so much going on. So we're going to go into the hormones and all that, and it's going to be lots of fun. So before we begin, this is all not medical advice. This is all simply education, and really important for you to make sure when you're teaching your clients, patients, if you're not in a situation where you're licensed to diagnose or treat that person, that you let them know that here I'm going to be giving you advice and education about your lifestyle and your diet and all these other things, and it's just education, and you can work with your doctor if you're on any medications to help you make a decision about where to go with that. So hopefully that helps. So let's talk about the different hormones that can be playing around while we sleep. Sometimes I like to call it the dance that the hormones do during sleep. And what some of them are beneficial and some of them are not so good during sleep. So the hormones that can have a beneficial effect during sleep and actually enhance the sleep process and all the cleansing and rebuilding and repairing and all that that happens during sleep, and don't forget fat burning, which we'll talk about, those are growth hormone, melatonin, leptin, estrogen, progesterone, and testosterone. Those hormones that don't have such a hot effect during slumber are cortisol and insulin. And the ones that don't have such a great effect during slumber are the ones that during the day, having excesses of them can be problematic. So we're going to just take each of these hormones. We're going to talk about the role they play during sleep. We're going to talk about interactions between them so that when you have people presenting, which our next presentation in this series will be on sleep disorders. So when you have somebody who's presenting with particular sleep disorders or particular patterns of not being able to fall asleep or stay asleep or waking up at certain times, that you can start to really understand what might be going on a hormonal level. So let's talk about sleep and insulin resistance. This is something you've heard me speak about probably many times before, but sleep is, insulin resistance is something that can actually be hurt and be increased during sleep. So there's a lot of studies that relate to this. The effect of sleep deprivation on all of the hormones, the mental function, the blood sugar metabolism, energy, and weight, all of these happen during sleep. All of these things get enhanced during sleep. And so when a person is sleep deprived, they tend to end up throwing their hormones off, having lower mental function the next day, having an imbalance in blood sugar, energy, and weight because they don't get to do the appropriate fat burning. So we're going to talk about how to adopt a bedtime ritual that encourages sound sleep and including activities, herbs, and supplements that improve sleep, and understand how the sleep cycles work, which we've done already in part one, and how to choose bedtime routine that optimizes deep sleep. And the reason for that, and we went through that in a lot of detail in the first part of this presentation, was that when you optimize the sleep pattern, you can actually improve insulin resistance. So we're going to look at how the hormones interact during sleep so you can optimize those and help people to optimize those. So some studies on sleep deprivation and insulin resistance. Sleep debt causes an impairment in endocrine, cardiovascular, and immune systems. We talked about that already. But glucose clearance rate is depressed by 40% after 4 days of sleep deprivation. That's a lot. And that's just sleep of 4 hours a night. And it's comparable to the kind of changes we see in women with gestational diabetes. So a 40% decrease in the insulin, the glucose clearance rate, after a four-day deprivation of sleep to 4 hours a night. Now, a lot of people sleep 4 hours a night. What? All the time, or barely above 4 hours of sleep all the time. I know personally that I sometimes go long stretches of sleeping just 4 hours a night. And as a result, I developed insulin resistance even though I eat a really clean diet and exercise and, you know, manage my stress. So this is really critical in your go-getters, your executives, your people that push, and your insomniacs. They're going to have a hard time getting their glucose under control, getting their blood sugar under control. If they're already pre-diabetic and insulin resistant, they're going to have a hard time getting those fasting glucose numbers down until you can help them to get sleep. So it's really critical that we learn to help these people sleep. Here's another study that showed that glucose tolerance is decreased during sleep debt. And this was a study called The Roles of Time of Day and Sleep Quality in Modulating Glucose Regulation Clinical Implications. And when I read through these studies, it was shocking to me. And I was just like, yeah, sleep is just one of the things. And if everything else is good, you don't need as much sleep. And when I started to look at the evidence that this was not true, it blew my mind. There's another study called The Relationship Between Sleep Quality and Glucose Regulation in Normal Humans. Here's another study. 3 days of 10 to 12 hours of sleep can normalize fasting glucose. And there was a study, there was a chart that was put together. And this was the first time, the first study I read about this was just following one guy. And they followed this guy who was pre-diabetic, fasting insulin was like, fasting glucose, I keep saying insulin, fasting glucose was about 119. And they put him on this sleep program and they had him sleep, you know, anywhere from, I think it was for him, it was 9 to 10 hours a night. And they kept watching the glucose and you saw this chart and it just goes down and down and down. So his fasting glucose within like 4 days of sleeping 9 hours a day was down in the 90s. Not perfect yet, but pretty darn good after 4 days, right? Metformin can't come to that kind of claim to fame. So they kept watching him and then something happened where he couldn't get the full 9 hours, but he only got like 8 hours of sleep one night. His glucose creeped up a bit. Two nights in a row, maybe he went down to 7.5 hours. It kept creeping up. And then as soon as he got back to the 9 hours, it started going down again. So really, really good evidence. Now, everybody's going to be a little different, right? Because we're all about biochemical individuality and all that stuff. But it's really critical that you emphasize how important it is for people to get their sleep, especially if they are in that pre-diabetic, you know, insulin-resistant range where their blood glucose is between 100 and 120, and especially if they have that extra fat around the middle or they're brain fogged and they really want to solve these problems. Another one was sleep deprivation disrupts normal pattern of growth hormone surge during the first 3 hours of sleep. So growth hormone is one of our friendly hormones that helps us to decrease our fat mass and increase our lean body mass. It helps to do repair. And there's particular spikes in growth hormone. First spike happens during that first hour of sleep. So we fall asleep. It's actually the biggest spike of the night. Goes down. So at the beginning of each sleep cycle, we get a growth hormone surge. And the biggest one is at the beginning. Now, typically when people are sleep deprived, they're sleep deprived in the early hours of sleep. They generally can sleep at the end of the night or into the early morning, but they are deprived at the beginning. Not all. Some people fall asleep easily and then wake up at 4 and can't get back to sleep. But people, especially those people who are having difficulties falling asleep and don't fall asleep till after midnight, 1, 2, or stay up late because they're busy, they're night owls, etc., they're party animals, then those people are going to miss one of that very first growth hormone surge, which is going to lower their overall growth hormone, and that's going to interfere with all the repair and lean muscle building and fat burning. But even if they have the other end of it, where they fall asleep easily, they go to bed early, but they wake up and they can't get back to sleep in the middle of the night, they're still going to miss out on those last couple of cycles of sleep. And that's going to help keep their growth hormone down. And this study was done in Journal of Physiologic Regulation, Integrated Comprehensive Physiology, back in 2000. And it was all about sleep debt, adaptation of a 24-hour growth hormone profile to the state of sleep debt. So I think I've been convincing enough so far to say that sleep is super important for growth hormone and for insulin resistance. And now we're leading into for growth hormone. So sleep and growth hormone. Well, growth hormone increases protein synthesis in every cell in the body. It promotes the release of fat from cells. Growth hormone and insulin are considered almost antagonistic, right? It's between meals that the growth hormone elevates and after exercise, and once the insulin starts to rise after a meal, right after a meal within that 2 hours, the growth hormone drops. So in that time when we're not eating, when there's no food coming in and the insulin levels are low, growth hormone helps us to use the fat we have as fuel. It shifts the cell fuel from glycogen and glucose to fat. So it basically signals the cell, okay, no longer have to burn the glycogen or the glucose in the blood. Let's burn some fat. It promotes insulin sensitivity. So the more growth hormone we have, the more insulin sensitivity we have. The more insulin we have, the less growth hormone we have, and then, of course, the less sensitivity we have to it. So it's this vicious cycle. And when we can maximize and optimize the levels of both, it's really awesome. When does growth hormone get secreted? Well, it actually gets secreted in response to the stomach emptying via the hormone called ghrelin. Ghrelin is a hormone that secretes by the stomach to say, hey, we're getting empty. So when growth hormone senses the ghrelin, it says, oh, well, food supply is getting low. Let's just burn some fat. So that's really cool. That's one of the advantages of being hungry, at least for a little while. Some people say, as soon as I get hungry, I have to eat because otherwise it's going to stress the adrenals. But in reality, you're only going to go into that distress state if the hunger perceives for a really long time, and usually only when the person has a dysregulation of insulin and glucagon. So the emptying of the stomach will trigger growth hormone. So one of the things I like to tell my patients is, so when you start to feel hungry, embrace it, welcome it, enjoy it. Know that that's triggering fat burning. Don't let it go on too long because you'll get famished and weak and it's going to be counterproductive and metabolism may go down. But really embrace that and enjoy that half hour or so of enjoying the hunger. It's also secreted in response to amino acids. So if we have amino acids in the bloodstream, it's like, oh, let's take some growth hormone to turn these amino acids into protein, into muscle. It also is secreted in response to exercise. It increases with exercise intensity. And the studies have shown that most intense increase in growth hormone occurs when we do burst training, short bursts, 30-second bursts, very intense throughout the day, causes a rise in growth hormone for up to 90 minutes, similar to the way that 30 minutes of aerobic exercise does. So that's why we teach you to show your clients how to do burst training in between, you know, other things throughout the day. Makes it easy to do exercise because they're just doing 30 minutes at a time or 30 seconds at a time. It's very easy to fit into a busy schedule and it's so effective. It doesn't mean that cardiovascular exercise is not needed, etc., but it's a lot easier to get somebody to do a 30-minute burst of exercise and spread them out throughout the day 4 to 8 times than it is to get them to go out and do a half an hour of aerobics at a time. So that's where it is, and the more intense the exercise, the more growth hormone is secreted. And then, of course, deep sleep, right? So you get into there and boom, you start to go into that cycle, and an hour after you fall asleep, that's when you start to get the growth hormone spikes. So this is really cool. And the thing about growth hormone is that, like I said, it's antagonistic with insulin. So if the growth hormone goes up and it senses insulin, it causes the growth hormone to come back down. So this gives us a couple of different opportunities for behavioral modification. One is if your person eats right before they go to sleep and there's insulin in their system, what's going to happen to that growth hormone spike that's supposed to happen? It's not going to happen. So it's going to interfere with repair and lean muscle lay down and fat burning. So it's really important to know that. The other thing, if they do some intense exercise and during the exercise they're sucking down on one of those gel packs or goo packs or Gatorade because they think they need it, that's going to interfere with that growth hormone surge because it's going to cause a surge of insulin during the exercise, which is going to interrupt the growth hormone. If they decide, okay, they don't need it during, but they're going to do it after, and they do it within that 90 minutes after, especially during that first half hour to an hour after, it's going to disrupt that growth hormone surge that could have been doing some repair and muscle lay down and lean body mass. Now, it's not absolute as to the best amount of time after exercising to when they should eat something. It varies from person to person, physiology to physiology, and it also depends on what they're eating, right? So I always tell people, wait at least a half an hour to an hour after you finish your exercise before you put any food in your stomach, just to make sure that you maximize your growth hormone. Some people do really well with going a full 90 minutes. Some people do really well with not exercising, having breakfast before exercise, just going out and exercising. So it's really a matter of helping to find the right rhythm for your client in their particular case and their particular stage. But it's really important to keep these things in mind. And sleep is critical. So going back to sleep, if someone is having difficulty falling asleep, obviously they're not going to get as much growth hormone. If they are watching TV or being on the computer too close to bedtime, that's going to cause them to have a prolonged falling asleep time because it decreases the amount of melatonin secreted. So all of these hormones interact with each other. How do cortisol and growth hormone interact? Well, if you have a cortisol surge right before bed, it's going to inhibit growth hormone. And here's the deal. Why would you have a cortisol surge before bed? Well, getting upset, watching the news, having an argument with someone, doing some intense exercise, doing some intense mental activity right before bed. That can cause a surge of cortisol. So it's really important to help your clients to transition to bedtime into their parasympathetic nervous system, right? So do some heart math, do some tapping, do some meditation, some yoga to make that transition so that you don't go to bed with the cortisol up, which will then inhibit the growth hormone. Cortisol reduces the rate of fat burning. So which do we want during sleep? Do we want to reduce the rate of fat burning or increase? Now, some of you may argue that, hey, I'm underweight, or I have clients who are underweight. And some of the rules that we're putting together, you may actually want to know these rules so you can say, okay, so if I want to help this person to put on weight temporarily in a healthy way, how can I do it? Well, raising their cortisol before bed isn't a good way. But it might be okay to then eat a little snack before bed, you know, as long as it's a fat protein kind of a snack as opposed to a carbohydrate snack. Okay? So when you add growth hormone to the mix with cortisol, it can actually increase the rate of fat burning. So they've done that in the lab where they'll take somebody and they'll throw some cortisol and their growth hormone in. But naturally occurring in the body, that's kind of hard to do because the cortisol does inhibit the growth hormone surge. Right. What other hormones have an effect on sleep? Leptin. We talk about this in our appetite endocrinology section. Leptin is secreted by what? The fat cells, the white adipose tissue. And it signals the hypothalamus and the pancreas were full. The response is then to turn off appetite, which is good. We don't want to be hungry right before we go to bed. The pancreas response is to stop producing insulin, which is awesome. We want the leptin to be going on so we don't produce insulin during sleep. But leptin, in addition to responding to the we're full signal, it has a 24-hour circadian rhythm in addition to being controlled by eating. So some of the things that affect it are the timing of meals and the timing in particular of carbohydrates in meals. So it's found that people who have a higher carbohydrate snack in the morning are going to, or breakfast in the morning, are going to peak their leptin sooner. Their circadian rhythm of leptin is going to peak sooner. And so it's going to be starting to be on the decline after dinner instead of being on the rise after dinner and at a peak during sleep. And I'll show you a chart about that. So it's really a good idea. If you have people who are having difficulty with sleeping, there are some really cool things that you can do during the early part of the day as opposed to just at the bedtime in order to help that. And one is to have a no carbohydrate breakfast or low, a high fiber breakfast with some fat and protein. And I'm not talking bacon and eggs and ham and cheese and all that. It can still be a plant-powered breakfast that's high in protein and low in carbs. So it would be the low glycemic type, veggie type things and green powders with, chia seeds and hemp seeds and various things like that that are higher in protein, higher in fat, but very low in the glycemic load. So that's leptin. Let's look at some leptin and the normal leptin function, right? So if leptin is perceived properly and produced properly, both. So it can be produced properly, but not perceived properly, and that has to do with leptin resistance. But if you look at this, the leptin is on the rise starting at dinner and peaks usually 2 hours into sleep. And so if the leptin is on the rise after dinner, generally you're not going to feel hungry. You're not going to feel that urge and that need to snack. But I'm sure many of your clients and patients have that problem of, well, I just get hungry after dinner. At about 10 o'clock, I'm feeling like, wow, I really need to eat something. And they have a snack before going to bed. And it's a hard habit to break. So one of the reasons is because the leptin will peak earlier, and I'll show you that in the next slide. So here's what happens during sleep. So 2 hours after sleep, when leptin is at its max, the fat burning begins. So it's like, okay, we got plenty of leptin here. Let's start fat burning. So the fat burning starts to go. Plus, you've got a good surge of growth hormone going on. And between, like, say, midnight and 8 a.m. is your prime fat burning, right? You're just increasing it. So that's when you really want to do it. And the leptin starts to go down, but it's not down to its kind of baseline level until 8 a.m. So if we look at what happens in leptin resistance, or when you have food eaten earlier in the day, this kind of precipitates it. Well, in leptin resistance, you're actually going to see that leptin peaking too early, right? So it's peaking here, right? And it starts to go down. And then when leptin's on its way down is when we start to get hungry. So it's like, maybe 9, 10 o'clock, it's a few hours after eating, and someone's super hungry. We get that craving. My son used to note that if he went to bed before 10, it was fine. He didn't get a craving for food, but if he went to bed after 10, he did. I thought that was interesting. So the leptin starts to go down. So we get intense food cravings because it's perceived, oh, the leptin's going down. Okay, we got to start eating again. And then the digestion of food happens during sleep because if you've eaten. So instead of all the cleansing and clearing and liver and gallbladder and everything else, then wow, what happens is it doesn't happen. And so you're digesting food instead. And so that causes more sluggish liver. More sluggish liver can create decreased conversion of T4 to T3. It can create hormonal clearance problems. It can create, detoxification problems. So there's all kinds of things. Okay. And so what happens is you're getting minimal fat burning during sleep. And so people go, well, I'm not eating that much. Why am I not losing weight? So leptin resistance is key. Now, we find that with eating carbs in the morning, you actually see this peak actually a little bit earlier, but somewhere in that range, around dinner time, you're starting to have this peak, and then after dinner, it's coming down, and you just can't get enough. These are people who are ravished and cannot get enough food. So that's that. So when we look at these hormones, we want to start to manage them appropriately, and we'll go into a lot more managing techniques in a later presentation, but for now, there's always these specific things that you want to do to manage the leptin and the insulin so that you have optimal fat burning and minimum fat storage. So don't eat after dinner, right? And it's a hard one to break if they're on this cycle and they have insulin resistance and leptin resistance and they're eating carbs early in the day. So I find that when you can get them to stop eating so early in the day and not snacking between meals, it keeps the insulin levels, it allows the insulin levels to go up and down, up and down, up and down. Whereas when someone's eating that 5 to 6 meals a day, like a lot of folks are recommending, the insulin levels are going to be up, and then they stay up, they start to go down, and then we eat again, up, up. So you're basically in fat storage mode all day, and you're interfering with leptin, you're interfering with growth hormone, and it's causing a major disruption in the cycle. So only eat 3 meals a day. Allow, I like 5 or 6 hours between meals. Many people say I can't do it. So you start with wherever they are and you just start gradually increasing the spacing between meals. And there's other advantages to that. We talk about that in other parts of the program. But like, for example, the migrating motor complex, which helps keep things moving along, kind of the peristalsis of the small intestine, if you will, keeps things moving along the intestinal tract. That only comes and starts to really maximize its effects about 3.5 hours after eating. So allowing the spacing between meals allows us to have really enjoy the insulin going down, the growth hormone staying up. It allows us to be able to have the proper movement in the gut and optimize. So it's optimizing blood sugar, it's optimizing digestion, and it's overall going to optimize how the person feels and their weight. So it's really important. The overly large meals. Now, people say, well, how can I eat only 3 meals a day or 2 meals a day and not eat large meals? I said, well, it's not that hard, but you want to eat filling and satisfying meals, yes, but you don't want to eat like meals that are going to make you feel like, you know, you're overly stuffed. And that's what people tend to do. So you eat a good proportion, lots of fiber and lots of fat. And maybe not lots of fat for everybody, but fiber, lots of fiber and fat in the meal will help someone feel satiated. Eating slowly helps a lot for managing these hormones. Having a breakfast containing protein and avoiding the starchy carbohydrates or even fruit or juice at breakfast so that you don't get that carbohydrate surge, which then causes an early leptin surge. So it's just some of the things. And overall, all of this is going to help them with sleep. So let's look at ghrelin and sleep. Ghrelin is secreted by the cells in the stomach wall. Eating suppresses ghrelin and having an empty stomach stimulates it. Ghrelin then suppresses appetite, but like we said before, ghrelin also helps to increase the level of growth hormone, at least temporarily. Sleep deprivation increases ghrelin and it increases hunger. Sleep deprivation has an impact on ghrelin and leptin. And what that does is that the next day after sleep deprivation, I know this is true for me, I'm ravenous. I just can't get enough food. I am hungry all day. I can't keep my appetite under control. And what happens is during those periods of sleep deprivation, you're going to burn fat less effectively. So you may have people say, well, I'm just barely eating. I'm not eating a high level of calories. Why am I gaining weight? Well, that this is why, is because these hormones are out of balance and you're not able to, your sleep is, you're deprived, which causes more ghrelin and less leptin, or increases leptin resistance in some cases. And they're hungry and they're slowing down, and they're slowing down fats burning, increasing fat storage. And so you may be able to go on much less calories. So as people start to increase their sleep without increasing the amount they eat, they may naturally see a drop in the weight. Ghrelin is a potent stimulator of growth hormone. We talked about that. And then if you wait to eat until you're very hungry and your stomach is empty, you're going to stimulate fat burning and muscle sparing. And like I said earlier, I don't mean that you get to the point where you're like passed out. I have to eat, got to eat, going to kill somebody in the state of, you know, adrenal stress. No, but it's that, oh, I'm a little hungry. Oh, I'm getting a little more hungry. Oh, I'm a lot hungry. Oh, maybe I'll eat now, right? As opposed to, oh, I got an itch. I got to scratch it right now. No, you know, you don't eat immediately upon sensing that there's some emptiness. You wait till you're healthfully hungry. And that's a good thing to teach people. So let's talk about sleep deprivation and hunger. I've already alluded to this. Sleep deprivation decreases leptin, increases ghrelin, and stimulates hunger, obviously. A reduction of sleep duration to 4 hours for 2 consecutive nights only has recently been shown to decrease circulating leptin and ghrelin, and increase ghrelin, as well as self-reported hunger. Just 2 days. So it's not like you have to be going weeks of this before this happens. And this is a study in the PubMed. Okay, so we've looked at the hormones, kind of a lot of them related to food and appetite and growth hormone. Let's take a step at looking at a hormone whose primary role is sleep. So melatonin is produced by the pineal gland, and it's stimulated by low light conditions. So the pineal gland, when there's light coming in through the eyes, then it stimulates melatonin to shut down. So darkness is what stimulates melatonin. And I believe we have a lot of our sleep issues in our society is because we don't really follow the natural rhythms of the earth and of life. We're basically in these boxes with electricity, and we can have light anytime. We can have bright daylight at 3 a.m., and many of us do. We also have devices, and those devices are shooting light into our eyes at a very close range. So it's turned on by low light conditions. It's turned off by bright light. And so if you're sitting, somebody who's saying, I can't fall asleep, and I keep waking up in the middle of the night, and they're sleep deprived, and they're gaining weight, and you start to ask them questions like, what do you do right before you go to bed? Most people are on their cell phone or on their computer or on their iPad, either watching a movie or on their TV, watching something, responding to email. They're doing things that are not only stimulating, which is turning on the sympathetic nervous system, which isn't conducive to sleep, but they're doing things that are causing light to go into the eyes at close range. And that turns off the melatonin. So, you know, days and then years of this can be creating a problem with melatonin and a problem with sleep. So whenever we're looking at people with sleep issues, we really have to look at it as a multifactorial event. And we'll go through all the details of that in the fourth part of this content. So promotes deep sleep. It also protects from tumor growth. There have been studies that have found that women with breast cancer have been found to have lower levels of melatonin. So a lot of us say, oh, we just stay up late, it's no big deal. But really, by decreasing the amount of melatonin that's circulating in our system, we're actually putting ourselves at risk, and in particular breast cancer, the studies that I've seen. So it's reduced by computer and TV at night, yes. It's also inhibited by eating too close to bedtime. Melatonin comes from serotonin. So it's produced from tryptophan, requires B6 for synthesis. So we have tryptophan, B6, they get converted to 5-hydroxytryptophan, to serotonin, and then to melatonin. So you can have a deficiency of melatonin as a result of their activities, right? They're eating too close to bedtime, bright light too close to bedtime. But also, you can have a deficiency because of a deficiency of B6, vitamin B6, right? Which comes from people eating too refined a diet, and also from just not having the right metabolism or not having the receptors or not having enzymes for it. There's so many reasons for not having enough B6 and also amino acids. So why would they not have enough tryptophan? Well, they could be not eating enough tryptophan. It is an essential amino acid. But they can also be that it's not that they're not eating enough, that they're not digesting enough. So that goes back to looking at the stomach acid and the digestion. So it's really important that we look at this. A lot of people want to say, well, let's just give a person melatonin, which is fine. I mean, it's a really safe thing to do. And, you know, sometimes I'm at that, let's get them sleeping no matter what it takes. And sometimes pharmaceuticals are required, although I would try to get people away from that because they become so addictive and they don't necessarily work. But you got to get them sleeping. I mean, they can't get well unless they sleep. So what you might be doing is saying, okay, let's take melatonin, which is great, but just taking melatonin is a Band-Aid, right? Remember, we don't want to go for just Band-Aids. Yes, we love our Band-Aids. Yes, we give out Band-Aids freely when needed to solve the acute situation, but we always have to be looking deeper. Why is there not enough melatonin? Is it because there's a deficiency of tryptophan and B6? Is there an impairment in that mechanism? Is there an impairment of serotonin, maybe due to some digestive issues? And is it because of their activities during the day and night? So all those things play in. Let's look at progesterone. Progesterone actually promotes deep sleep. When we look at bioidentical hormone supplementation, generally, you know, taking them orally has been shown to be problematic, except progesterone can be taken orally, and it's actually used a lot to help people get deep sleep. So I'm not saying just give them a band-aid of progesterone if they're having a problem, but that could be an issue, right? So looking at what's going on in their cycles, what's going on, are they estrogen dominant, progesterone deficient? There's a lot of things to look at. So, but progesterone can be very helpful for people who are having sleep difficulties. Progesterone helps prevent lipid peroxidation, which is really awesome because it blocks the atherogenic effects of cortisol. So cortisol in excess can cause atherosclerosis by hardening and thinning of the arteries. Progesterone, most people don't know, also has anti-inflammatory and antioxidant effects. It reduces natural killer cells, TNF alpha, and TH1, T helper 1 cytokines. So this is really important to know in cases of chronic inflammation. And in fact, there's a lot of studies recently, and you can look this up online, there's a lot of studies on it that are using progesterone for traumatic brain injury to help reduce some of the swelling in traumatic brain injury, help the person to naturally sleep and have really positive effects. It also stimulates the production of interleukin 4 and 10 and increases the levels of reduced glutathione and superoxide dismutase. So those are two very important antioxidants and interleukins that are anti-inflammatory and help combat the more inflammatory interleukin 6s and some of the others in 13s and 16s. Now, progesterone also suppresses excess estrogen, which is really good with people who are estrogen dominant. Now, even people who go into menopause are sometimes estrogen dominant. So it's really important to be looking at estrogen and progesterone. So it suppresses excess estrogen and can help. Sometimes people have difficulty falling asleep because of the estrogen dominance. It activates GABA receptors. Well, what are GABA receptors? GABA is a neurotransmitter that's calming. And so if it's going to activate those receptor sites, it's going to have a calming effect on the brain. And also there have been some studies that show it's involved in regulating blood sugars. So cool stuff, all this stuff that we don't really think about these. We think about these in terms of sex, not so much as sleep. So let's look at estrogen. Estrogen significantly increases the amount of time people had in REM sleep, so when these studies were done. It reduces the time spent awake from 20 to 12 minutes during the first two sleep cycles of the night. So it has a deep sleep promoting effect, not just the hot flash control. A lot of people think the estrogen in a perimenopausal or postmenopausal woman, that estrogen supplementation helps them to sleep because of reducing the hot flashes, but in fact, it has some effects on the cycle in and of itself by increasing REM time and decreasing the shorter parts. Finally, let's look at testosterone. So, diminished testosterone is linked with snoring and sleep apnea, and I gave you a couple of studies there for you to have a look at. Sleep can increase testosterone. Okay? Sleep deprivation decreases testosterone. So the guy laying there snoring may have some decreased testosterone. So if you have people who are complaining that they snore, their partner tells them they snore, or their partner snores, you may want to have them start to look at the testosterone levels. Sleep deprivation decreases testosterone. A few extra hours of sleep. This is a cool statistic in this study. An extra few hours of sleep can double testosterone. So if you've got some male patients or even female patients with low testosterone who are complaining about this, andropause type stuff, and you can just explain to them that they just need a few extra hours of sleep and get them to do a sleep day vacation, which we'll talk a lot more about in our fourth section. Get them to do a sleep vacation that can dramatically improve their testosterone levels and make them have a happy partner either way. So that's the end of our hormones related to sleep, our endocrinology of sleep. You can see a lot of the interconnections, and we're going to pull it all together in a later part of this presentation when we look at, well, what do we do and what are the various approaches we can take to help people to get better sleep.